From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, John Kerry condemns Russia's role in feeding the growing unrest in eastern Ukraine to forge a pretext for military intervention.
Everything that we've seen in the last 48 hours from Russian provocateurs and agents operating in eastern Ukraine tells us that they've been sent there determined to create chaos.
Also today, 64-year-old U.S. contractor Alan Gross goes on hunger strike over his controversial imprisonment in Cuba. And as world-renowned horn player Hugh Masekela celebrates his 75th birthday, we discover how his African childhood influenced his modern-day jazz.
It was the golden age of music. You could spend from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning just club hopping.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russia has warned that any use of force in Ukraine's eastern region could lead to civil war, as Kyiv attempts to regain control following pro-Moscow protests. Ukrainian authorities have been clashing with pro-Russian protesters that stormed the regional administration in the eastern city of Kharkiv. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned Russia of harsher economic sanctions if it does not back down from involvement in Ukraine. Mr. Kerry is set to meet with top diplomats from Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union over the coming days. He said pro-Russia demonstrations in Kharkiv and Donetsk were contrived and a pretext for military intervention.
Quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary engaged in this initiative.
NATO has also warned Russia that continued efforts to destabilize Ukraine would be a historic mistake and threaten consequences. The trial of South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius, who stands accused of intentionally killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, came to a temporary halt after the athlete broke down crying in the witness stand. Pistorius had been giving testimony for the first time about the night he thought an intruder entered his bathroom and he shot Steenkamp behind a locked toilet door. Gary Alfonso reports from Pretoria, South Africa.
Pistorius finally broke down, struggled to speak, and then started crying out loud as he described how he found his badly wounded girlfriend behind the bathroom door he broke open with a cricket bat. Earlier, he had told the court how he had grabbed his gun from his bedside, whispered to Steenkamp to call the police, and approached the bathroom where he found an open window and he fired 4 shots through the toilet door. He said he screamed hysterically and cried for help when he realized it might have been Steenkamp behind the door. The judge adjourned the case for the day when the defense said Pistorius was too distraught to continue.
U.S. President Barack Obama is urging his political opponents to approve a gender pay equality law, which Congress previously rejected. Women in the United States earn on average only 77 cents to every dollar earned by men in the same job. The president has signed 2 executive orders bringing transparency to federal government contractors. The Paycheck Fairness Act would impose new regulations on private employers. Republicans say it amounts to a desperate political ploy designed to target women in an election year. But the president says there's a clear argument.
Because the majority of senators support this bill. But 2 years ago, a minority of Senate Republicans blocked it from getting a vote. Even worse, some commentators are out there saying that the pay gap doesn't even exist. They say it's a myth. But it's not a myth. It's math.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A new report from the United Nations has revealed more than 1.5 million people are in dire need of food in the Central African Republic. It comes after a year of religious-motivated violence that has killed thousands and forced many more from their homes. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Food insecurity has now almost become the norm in the Central African Republic. The 1.6 million figure represents more than a third of the entire population of 4.5 million. A joint study by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Programme shows fighting between Christian and Muslim communities has meant crops have not been planted and people have not been able to work the land. The report says action is becoming more difficult and expensive with every passing day.
The death toll from last month's landslide in the U.S. state of Washington has risen to at least 34. The county sheriff's office says around 10 people remain missing. Nearly 900 people have been working on search and recovery efforts in the area north of Seattle. And they were told they would never move their legs again, but thanks to a new experiment, four men with paralyzed legs have been able to regain some functions, including standing. The groundbreaking finding is giving people with paralysis new hope that the condition may not be permanent. Lindsay Mastis reports from Los Angeles.
It's called epidural stimulation. Researchers are running an electrical current through the men's spines, which seems to have restored the ability for their brains to once again control their legs. The four men who have participated in the study have each been paralyzed for 2 to 4 years. When the epidural device is running, they can lift their legs and support their own weight when they stand.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The intense focus on Ukraine continues. And everything that we've seen in the last 48 hours from Russian provocateurs and agents operating in eastern Ukraine tells us that they've been sent there determined to create chaos. And that is absolutely unacceptable. These efforts are as ham-handed as they are transparent, frankly. And quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary engaged in this initiative.
Secretary of State John Kerry there with his assessment on Russia's attempts to destabilize eastern Ukraine. He was speaking during a Senate foreign relations hearing on Tuesday and condemned Moscow's behavior as a pretext for military intervention, similar to Russia's earlier annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula, Crimea. The Secretary of State said the US and its allies will continue to punish Russia with economic sanctions if Moscow fails to take steps to de-escalate the situation. Damon M. Wilson, Executive Vice President at the Atlantic Council think tank, discussed these latest developments with me earlier.
I think what you're seeing is very clear, corrupt rhetoric, if you will, coming out of Moscow, sort of playing up almost a Soviet-like narrative of this issue of unrest and challenges to Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine, when the reality is there would be no crisis today in Ukraine if it weren't for the part of a concerted effort on the part of Moscow to stir up this unrest. And so you're seeing Secretary Kerry, Secretary General Rasmussen, EU leaders call the Russians bluff, sort of speak out against many of these lies, and warn the Russians not to go further into eastern Ukraine.
But that doesn't seem to be working, does it? Because at the moment, we've still got this, what the US understands is a very sizable Russian troop build-up along that Ukrainian border, and we haven't got any suggestion of that withdrawing anytime soon. And Russia maintains that if there is a threat to ethnic Russians in that eastern part of the country, they will intervene.
That's right. Look, if President Putin decides to go into Ukraine, there's very little that can stop him if he decides to take a very brazen course. I think that the best that the West can do is help spell out the costs, make clear that there are further measures that are deployed and ready to go. In fact, many of those can be acted on now as the narrative builds for further Russian intervention in Ukraine. To help try to impact his calculations of the cost that Russia will have to pay. But at the end of the day, this is going to be Vladimir Putin's decision on how brazen he wants to be in challenging not just his neighbor, but is challenging the entire international order and the cost that he's willing to bear as a result of that.
The US has said it will impose tougher sanctions, economic sanctions on Russia if it escalates this situation. We know the US Navy is sending a destroyer into the Black Sea. Is there any other suggestion here? Any other chance that there is a military response to Vladimir Putin's actions waiting in the wings, be it from the US or NATO as an alliance?
I'm here in Paris with a meeting of that's taking place with all the NATO ambassadors, the Secretary General here. Look, this is an alliance that's clearly geared up towards reassuring its own allies about the credibility of Article 5, thinking about how to move the alliance to its eastern borders, if you will, to help reassure Poland, Romania, the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. This is not an alliance that's going to be going to war with Russia inside Ukraine, but that doesn't mean there isn't a role and a place for NATO. NATO, after all, is a political military alliance. There are many things that the alliance can do to support the Ukrainians in help strengthening their own capacity to deter Russian forces, as well as helping to continue to advance Ukrainian interoperability with the alliance itself, whether it's from intelligence sharing or assistance with command and control, communication. The Russians clearly learned their lessons from the 2008 performance in Georgia, where they didn't do so well. We saw in Crimea that they actually acted on many of those lessons, cutting command and control, cutting communication wires, moving to suppress air defense very early on. And so there are non-direct ways of intervening that the alliance can be helpful to Ukraine as it tries to deter Russian efforts.
Damon M. Wilson, Executive Vice President at the Atlantic Council Think Tank. This is FSN Reports. A US government contractor is reportedly on hunger strike in protest of his treatment in a Cuban prison. 64-year-old Alan Gross stopped eating last week because of what he calls the inaction of American and Cuban governments. That's according to his lawyer. Mr. Gross was imprisoned in 2009. At the time of his arrest, he was working on behalf of the US Agency for International Development to increase internet access for Jewish communities across Cuba. He was sentenced to 15 years after Cuban authorities charged him with undermining the government by illegally bringing communications equipment onto the island. Jill Zuckman is a spokesperson for Alan Gross and joined me earlier.
5 days ago, Alan Gross decided to go on a hunger strike, and I think it's safe to say that he has lost any hope of getting out of this prison in Havana, where he's been kept for the last 4 years and 4 months. I think this was a last gasp at trying to get the governments of Cuba and the United States to pay attention to his situation and resolve it. His health is very poor. Prior to the hunger strike, he had lost over 110 pounds while he was in prison. He has not done well. He lives in a small cell. The lights are on 24 hours a day. He is let out for only an hour a day into a small courtyard. His spirits are not good. His health is not good. And I can tell you that his family is worried sick that this hunger strike, that he won't survive this hunger strike.
And Jill, can you explain to us what Mr. Gross was actually doing as a U.S. contractor in Cuba?
Alan Gross was sent by the U.S. Agency for International Development to Havana to try to help the Jewish community in Havana get access to the internet. He was on his fifth trip to Cuba for USAID when he was arrested and put in prison. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He's been there 4 years and 4 months. He's got 11 years to go. He is 64 years old, so if he lived to reach the end of his sentence, he would be 75 by the time he got to go home. But I have to tell you that his family and his friends just don't believe that he can survive for 11 more years.
Alan Gross's hunger strike comes at the same time another story has emerged from Cuba involving USAID. What can you tell us about the relationship between those two stories?
Well, we learned last week about this Cuban Twitter program, Zunzuneo. And Alan learned about it, and I think it's safe to say that he and his advisors feel very strongly that USAID put his life in even greater jeopardy than it was already in. That program was started after Alan had been arrested and put in prison. And we think it makes it harder to get him out rather than easier. I think his lawyers feel like it's one more stick in the eye of the Cuban government, and one more reason why the Cubans won't allow him to leave.
And what has the Obama administration's response been to the case of Alan Gross?
Well, certainly high-level officials in the U.S. government have met with Alan's wife, Judy. They've met with their lawyers, and they've expressed a great deal of concern. But as to what steps they're taking to bring him home, we really don't know. And at this point, I can tell you that Alan, in a statement we put out today, asked the President of the United States to get personally involved in securing his release. And we believe that at this point, this just can't be handled by lower-level government officials. The President needs to get involved.
Spokesperson for Alan Gross, Jill Zuckman. Now, David Akerson is perhaps the person who contributed most to organising evidence for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He was hired as the Chief of Information and Evidence, and he compiled a massive digitised database of information on the genocide. Akerson is now a law professor at the University of Denver, where he has organised a series of events commemorating the 20th anniversary of the genocide. FSN's Mary McCarthy spoke with him and began by asking him about the challenges the tribunal presented.
So I will say, in terms of the successes of the Rwanda tribunal, we indicted 90 suspects. The UN's mission was to take the people that were seen to be the more serious planners, organizers, and perpetrators at a high level of the genocide. There were 100,000 low-level guys because it was a genocide that was perpetrated by a civilian population as opposed to the Nazis, who actually had used a mechanized military force to perpetrate their genocide. So it was a different model. But just by virtue of the fact that you were prosecuting in a very high-profile way leaders and organizers of the genocide instead of what many victims see as the real perpetrators is the guy who's in their village with the machete, and that political leaders are never held accountable. I think it really revolutionized the view of people in Rwanda that these crimes are planned meticulously, they're not spontaneous, and that there is an international law that people are held accountable to, even when there isn't a local law that would hold a political leader accountable. So just establishing the rule of law is really significant in the Rwanda context. I think it also did a lot to establish a baseline of what justice has to be in serious cases. And that's clearly evident in the Rwandan judiciary. It is part of the mandate. It's not at the time that they conceived the Rwanda tribunal, it wasn't so explicit. It is in these later tribunals, but imparting norms and expectations of due process by demonstrating how at least the developed world views due process has really done a lot to creating an expectation in Rwandans about rights that they have and due process that they should receive from their own judiciary. I think one of the most important things that came out of the Rwanda tribunal was the fact that it forced the world to recognize the gravity of the crime, to confront its role in that crime, its inaction, its failure to respond, and also recognize that things that are seemingly internal matters are really of international concern. And in almost every circumstance now, like Syria or the Crimea, going on right now, one of the first things you hear about is, should there be a tribunal No one questions the fact that whether a tribunal has a right to be created. That's a foregone conclusion that tribunals, they exist, they're valid, they're legitimate.
In terms of your perspective on humanity, was there a traumatic experience to that?
Yeah. So you do have to wrestle with the fact that you're grappling with these massive crimes, brutal crimes, and you do have to constantly remind yourself of the good in the world, because it's easy to get myopic when you're only looking at the worst that's going on. On the other hand, it does give you this amazing insight into the survivors and the courage they exhibit when they come to court and muster the courage to tell their story in front of the the serious bad guys who've planned these crimes. So I think a lot of people who worked at these tribunals would say one of the best parts of being involved in the process is standing up next to a woman who's been raped repeatedly and see her tell the story in a courtroom that's very foreign to her, that's very intimidating. But at great personal expense, she's doing it knowing how important it is for the healing in her country, for her country to be better than it was. That's pretty magnificent.
David Akerson with FSN's Mary McCarthy. Now, early April is the time for Chinese families across the globe to come together at the graves of their loved ones to pay respect. For many ethnic Chinese who live outside of China, it's also an opportunity to pass on traditions to the next generation here in the United States. FSN's Rachel Silverman reports on the Qinming Festival, or Tomb Sweeping Day as it's known, from a cemetery in Colma, south of San Francisco.
Hello, Zhoupo.
Four generations of the Huang family have come to the Cypress Lawn Cemetery to pay their respects to the family matriarch. They're remembering Ya Huar Lai and passing on the traditions of Qinming to her great-grandchildren. Lisa Huang is Ya Huar Lai's granddaughter.
We want to pass on the culture, so it's important that by me to show him my kid, later on he's able to show his kids too.
She says everyone's busy, but when it comes to Qinming, no excuses. It's important to make the time for the ritual.
It's just family value. We want to pass it on. And there's no really why or why not. We just always do it.
They bow three times, burn incense, and pour wine over the grave. They also burn paper products that could be useful in the afterlife. Everything from paper money to paper houses, cars, and even servants. Cypress Lawn Cemetery Family Service Arranger Benny Chin says Qinming traditions in the U.S. are similar to those in China, but they do vary from family to family.
We have a lot of people like who were born here. They're either taught from their parents or they come to us for education. We tell them what we typically do, but it's an option to family. Not everybody does exactly the same thing.
In the 1880s, the bodies of Chinese railroad workers were sent from California back to China for burial. Now, many of the more than 3.3 million ethnic Chinese living in the United States go back to China to visit the graves of their loved ones. But with more and more people from China coming to live in the U.S., Cypress Lawn family counselor Anita Sitt says many families are bringing the remains of their loved ones in China to be reburied in gravesites in the United States.
Paying respect to their ancestors is a very important thing for the Chinese tradition. And instead of, you know, taking time off, flying back to China, it's really better for them to, you know, bring the loved ones over here and pay their respects over here every year.
That's what Lisa Huang's family did for her grandmother, who died more than a decade ago in China. Documents were signed and shipment arranged this year, and today she's being honored by her son, his children, and grandchildren. Rachel Silverman, Colma, California.
And finally tonight, world-renowned horn player Hugh Masekela is in no doubt over the impact the music scene of New York City made upon his work. He grew up in South Africa listening to the great jazz music coming out of the city, and it was here where he really began to craft his trade. Celebrating his 75th birthday, and as part of his US tour, he's back in New York and is putting on a very special show. William Denslow reports from New York.
Hugh Masekela is used to being centre stage, but admits he's not one, for self-indulgence. At New York's Lincoln Center, however, fans have come to celebrate his 75th birthday. Introducing him to the stage, Masekela's son, Sal, reassures this full house that he shows no signs of slowing down.
For some reason, he does not get old. And you will see that when he gets on stage tonight.
Dressed in a button-up brown shirt and black waistcoat, Hugh Masekela is in a mischievous mood. Amusing the crowd with his raunchy gyrating, he captivates with his horn playing and powerful vocals. Masekela concedes that he misses the occasional note, but insists that age has nothing to do with it.
The musicianship of our group is amazing. It amazes even me sometimes. I miss cues, just sometimes being fascinated by like how well they're playing.
Escaping apartheid South Africa, he came to New York in the 1960s, and from day one, seeing the likes of Dizzy Gillespie and Coltrane, immersed himself in the city's jazz scene.
It was the golden age of music, and you could spend from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning just club hopping.
Masekela has no particular affinity for the city, though. Joking with his manager from his hotel room towering over Central Park, he says that you can't eat the view. For a musical education, though, it was invaluable. Between practice sessions and going to jazz clubs, Masekela was also enrolled at the prestigious Manhattan School of Music.
It was round the clock. We actually looked forward to the holidays, you know, where we could have a little respite from, because the classes were very rough.
Stood by a piano and stack of jazz CDs in the living room of his Upper West Side apartment, Morris Goldberg practices on his saxophone. Even as a white South African during apartheid, he jammed with Hugh Masekela when they were both teenagers back in Cape Town and has played with him sporadically throughout his career. He left South Africa in the 60s too and met up again with Hugh as a fellow student at Manhattan School of Music. With only a small group of South Africans living in New York at the time, Goldberg says there was a lot of pressure on them to succeed.
We were always, you know, judged, especially if it was a black and white person playing together. So it wasn't just a musical statement you were making, but you were making a political statement.
Manhattan School of Music has moved locations since Masekela was a student, but its reputation remains. There was no formal jazz program when he was there, but aspiring jazz musicians like Benny Banak and Adam O'Farrell now look up to Masekela as a source of inspiration. Finding room to play between the drum kit and piano in a small practice room, these young musicians say it's not the music alone that makes Masekela special. Here's Banak.
He made his music kind of transcend notes on the page, and it became about something bigger, you know? And I think all of us, any artist, obviously that's the goal, you know, to touch people and have your music be about something deeper than, you know, the notes.
Masekela may be an influence to young musicians, but he says he's still being inspired himself. The musicianship in his band can still wow him, and with his old friend Paul Simon playing at his birthday for a one-off cameo, there's even more cause for distraction. William Denslow, New York.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, we're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Wednesday, as NATO warns Russia against making an historic mistake, we look at the options left for the United States and the alliance if Russia decides to invade Ukraine. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.